Welcome to World Affairs, the weekly broadcast of the World Affairs Council. I'm Jane Wales, your host. Today, the Middle East seems very far from achieving an end to the Palestinian-Israeli conflict. For the longest time, we focused on a two-state solution in which Israel and Palestine could exist side by side in peace. Refugees would have some form of right of return, and Jerusalem would be divided. But this is in question now. Today we're talking to two leaders, one Israeli, one Jordanian, each of whom is known for having worked tirelessly for peace and for the political and economic development of the Middle East. Between them, they've held virtually every senior role in their respective governments. Joining us is Ehud Barak. He's the former prime minister and former minister of defense of Israel. And Marwan Muasher, former minister of foreign affairs and the deputy prime minister of Jordan. This program is made possible each week by the generous support of Chevron and the Draper Richards Kaplan Foundation. First, we'll turn to my interview with Ehud Barak. As prime minister, you led your country out of a prolonged recession and into economic boom. But for someone looking from the outside in, what is most impressive were your efforts to achieve peace. At Camp David, you were proposing two states for two people, with Jerusalem as a shared capital. Arafat balked. What did you conclude? Did he lack the will or did he lack the authority?
I cannot fully penetrate, but the fact that myself and Clinton put such a far-reaching offer, we never tried to dictate it to him. We never said take it or leave it. We just asked him to take it as a basis for negotiation. He deliberately rejected it and turned to terror. That told the story for us, or I told Clinton at the time, look, Mr. President, this man already holds Nobel Peace Prize. I think he probably better deserves an Oscar.
Now, you note that Bill Clinton played a very active role. Compare the experience with Bill Clinton to the U.S. approach now.
It's a totally different character. Clinton was a man of details, with deep and wide and profound understanding of the positions of all sides, and made a deliberate effort to be perceived by both sides as honest broker. When I came to power, he already dealt with it for 6 years. I knew some of it because I was before then foreign minister, and before foreign minister, I was the chief of the general staff, commander of the army, and we were involved in negotiations as well. And it was already after he mediated a peace with Jordan. And so he was very deep into details himself and was this personal source of authority. Here we are dealing with a new president who basically delegated it to capable people, Jared Kushner and Jason Greenblatt. They are very capable young people. And they are trying their best. We still have to see whether they bring to the table something that will be profound enough on one hand, and may I say tempting enough on the other hand, with as little amount of hard decision for each side. And let's hope it will fly. I'm not sure. I doubt it very, very deeply.
Now, many are saying in the region are saying, well, the U.S. No longer can put itself forward as an honest broker in large measure, if not entirely, as a result of our decision regarding Jerusalem. Do you think it is the barrier that some feel it is?
No, I don't think so. I think the issue of the capital in Jerusalem is extremely exaggerated, so to speak. It had to be done 70 years ago when Israel was established. For sure, it had to be done 25 years ago when the Congress, in bipartisan resolution, passed a resolution that ordered the president to move to Jerusalem, and the president just get a small door to wave it every 6 months. So it was delayed for 25 years for no reason. Now, Arabs and especially Palestinians are alienated by this decision, but for no real reason, because the decision to move the American embassy into the basically West Jerusalem, Israeli capital, does not exclude the possibility that at certain point, when the Palestinians will come to grip with reality and will be ready to strike a deal with Israel, establish their state, they will announce their capital. It probably will include certain suburbs or neighborhoods, heavily populated Arab neighborhoods of East Jerusalem. And so they can decide that their capital is there, and for sure the American embassy will be established there. So I don't see the issue as really critical. It has a lot of symbolic meaning for us, and so all Israelis welcome President Trump for making this happen.
Now, were there a resumption of negotiations and the Jerusalem issue resolved, what would be the right approach to settlements?
No, I think that even now we have to define a right approach towards the settlement. Even if agreement will be delayed for 5 or 10 years, I hope not, of course, but it might happen. We still have to have a practical policy on the ground, because every day something happens. You need new schools, new kindergartens, new roads, new suburbs for existing settlements and so on. So our policy is the following. We, Israelis, from both sides, left and right, we all agree that the settlement blocks and the Jewish neighborhoods in eastern Jerusalem, which altogether include probably 80% of the Israeli settlers, deployed on a piece of ground which doesn't cover more than 6 or 8%, someone might call it 10% of the area of the West Bank, an area which could be compensated somehow through land swaps. So we believe that this is going to stay part of Israel under any circumstance, including permanent status negotiations. So the whole debate in Israel is about what we call the isolated settlements, beyond this line of settlement blocks, which is basically relatively close to the old border. Because those isolated settlements, there are several dozens of them. They cover many dozens of thousands of settlers, but less than 20% of them. They are deployed all over the area in between any two significant Palestinian villages and towns. And that becomes an obstacle on the way to any future agreement. In fact, the reason why our government is insisting on keep activity in those isolated settlements is exactly in order to block any possibility of two-state solution in the long term. And that's at the core of our debate, because we are former leaders of Israel security and political leaders of center and left strongly believe that those isolated settlements are not asset for our security, they are burden on our security, and that we have to focus on the mastering the political will to delineate a line within the Holy Promised Land, within which we'll have a solid Jewish majority for generations to come, and beyond which we'll still keep security control, but there will be a place for a viable Palestinian state when the time comes and they are ripe for it.
If the Netanyahu government or the coalition government seeks to block a two-state solutions, are you arguing that a consensus nonetheless exists in the population, amongst security specialists, generals, et cetera, and does it remain viable?
I think that it's viable. Of course, the government tried to tell the public that it's all over. We crossed certain point of no return and it cannot be resumed and so on. And some people on the extreme left tend to believe the same, but I don't buy it. It won't be easy. It's never been easy. The Middle East is a tough neighborhood, and the decisions which should be made either to fight or to strike a deal or make peace, these are always tough decisions, but we have to be able to make them. We are the strongest country 1,000 miles around Jerusalem. And we are so strong that we can defeat any immediate neighbor or combination of neighbors. And we should act out of strength and self-confidence and ask ourselves what's good for Israel. So I'm convinced that we should never lose sight of this option of delineate or disengaging from the Palestinian, delineate a line of border. You all remember the line of Robert Frost, the poet, good fences make good neighbors, and we have to start to do it even if the neighbor is not ripe for it.
You have scoffed at the notion that Israel should fear the Palestinians. Do you think that Prime Minister Netanyahu is proceeding on the basis of lack of confidence on the part of Israel?
First of all, I should say that Mr. Netanyahu is the freely elected Prime Minister of Israel. So his government, however wrong I think their policies are, his government is my government as well, and is its legitimate government. But having said that, in the recent years, especially the last 3 years, when he has a fully right-wing government, every minister is right-wing, every party is right-wing, basically, we can see a direction. They really, Bibi does not really lead it. He is dragged behind the extreme right, which demand action to close the door on any possibility of disengagement or divorce from the Palestinians. And what happens to Netanyahu himself is a thoughtful person. He's not a lightweight, knowledgeable, he understands history and has a lot of political experience and even certain achievements, you should admit. But he developed in the recent several years a mood of extreme pessimism, passivity, deep anxiety, and sense of self-victimhood or victimization. I don't know how to put it in English. So this is a good recipe for surviving in power. He probably wants to survive in power, but that's a bad, poor recipe for statesmanship. It's always easier not to decide anything, and whatever happens, you always can complain about circumstances or the Almighty or whatever. But Zionism was based on a decision to change this pattern and take our fate in our hands and do things which are needed proactively in order to make sure that we maximize the chances of the good trajectory to take over. So, you know, with this mood of pessimism, passivity, anxiety, and self-victimization, you end up producing self-fulfilling prophecies. You know, if you are acting against the Palestinian Authority, for example, to weaken it, and there are several ministers who made it their personal baby, they are responsible for whatever, some bizarre area of government activities, but they all day talk about how to destroy the Palestinian Authority. Now, I used to tell them, tell me, whom do you think will come to replace the Palestinian Authority if you succeed in destroying it? Will it be the youth of Beitar, which is the movement of Likud? Will it be Bnei Akiva, which is the movement of the religious Zionists? No, it will be the Hamas. And when the Hamas will come, you will complain, how comes? We told you the Hamas will come, but you did it in your own steps. So basically, we have to be open-minded and sober. In the Middle East, those who are weak or not grounded to earth will not survive. So we should never underestimate any threat. We should never always be prepared for any kind of development, but do it from position of strength and always look at what are the ways, not just to kill mosquitoes effectively, but to start draining the swamp.
Talk a little bit about Mahmoud Abbas, the leader of the Palestinian Authority. How strong is he now? How committed is he now? There's some signs of having given up. What is your assessment?
I feel, I didn't meet him recently, but I feel that he's on decline and losing his grip on immediate events, or for sure on the possibility of taking a great courageous decisions. And you know, when I listened to his recent speech some 6 weeks ago, which brought back anti-Semitic kind of themes that he refrained from using for 2 decades now, I feel that probably he will not be the man with whom we will have to strike a deal. But let's wait, and we should have patience. You know, it's a war can be imposed by one party. For peace, it takes two. It's like tango. You cannot impose it. But it doesn't mean that we should be paralyzed or that we have nothing to do. The most urgent task for our generation is to put a wedge on this slippery slope toward one state solution. One state is a tragedy for the Zionist project, because it will end up inevitably either as a non-Jewish state or non-democratic state, because there is a block of millions of Palestinians with apparent national aspirations that should remain permanently under our boots, or if they vote, turning the country into a binational state overnight. In fact, binational state with Muslim majority in few years.
Now you're fearful that a single state would not be a democracy. Do you think that apartheid is necessarily a response, or could there be a kind of a civil rights based system?
I deliberately do not use this A word of description of the regime in a neighboring continent in the previous century, but because history never repeats itself, but it somehow rhymes. I'm worried that our leadership, out of probably a certain kind of biblical enthusiasm or messianic tinge, lost the capacity to look at reality with clear, open eyes. When Israeli right-wingers argue that, oh, we have a biblical right, an historic right for the whole country, how come we give it up? I tell them, look, of course we have the right. I feel the same. We have natural, historic, biblical, whatever, right for the whole country. But the question whether we implement or execute this right is up to political leaders to make the decision.
Well, you said that Palestinians don't pose a kind of an existential threat, but many feel that Iran does pose that threat to Israel. So I wanted to take you back both to the decisions leading up to the Iran nuclear deal, but also the decision of the U.S. to pull out. It seems that there's unity among Israel, Saudi Arabia, maybe the Emiratis and others, that Iran represents a threat to all of them. Did you think the nuclear deal was a smart one? And do you now think it wise to withdraw?
In my book, My Country, My Life, which just published recently, I describe in very detailed way what happened even before the deal. When we, Israel, I was more hawkish than Netanyahu or Lieberman on this issue, should prepare itself to take independent surgical operation against the Iranian nuclear facilities.
Surgical strikes, that would be.
Yeah, surgical military strikes, yeah. But that, for whatever reasons that you can find in the book, it didn't happen. And then came the deal. The deal cut under our international legitimacy. You cannot attack the nuclear sites of Iran when there is a deal between the all the powers of the world and Iran. And I thought it's a bad deal. But once it was signed, it became part of reality. It doesn't matter, you know. And we had to sit down with the Obama administration and discuss what should bring back the military option, how can we make sure that enough intelligence resources are invested in it, that we will know when they try to break out, and what is the definition of breakout. These issues have not been discussed carefully with Obama, and they should be discussed now with Trump. Now, I thought when the Trump came that it started to raise it, that there is more logical way to deal with those extra activities of the Iranians, which are not part of the deal. You know, developing missiles has to do with nuclear capabilities, but unfortunately, it's not part of the deal. Probably the deal could not be signed. Probably the Russians or the Chinese would veto it. Doesn't matter. It's not part of the deal. The same applied to sowing terror or insurgency or deploying in Syria. If we want these issues to be dealt, I thought the president can call upon the Europeans, probably the Russians, and start another round of negotiation. But once again, once he pulled out America from the deal, that's a new reality. You have to relate to it. So I see bad and good news. The good news is that Iranians turned more cautious. They are really worried that the Trump administration is probably, after pulling out, looking for the slightest violation of the deal, or probably even they suspect even fabricated excuse, and America will attack their nuclear facilities and destroy them. Recently, after Pompeo's speech, which put some 12 conditions or demands which they can never follow, They suspect that probably the administration is looking for an excuse to get into full clash with the regime itself, because Iran will survive a clash with America, but the regime will not survive it. So this is the real nightmare. So they start to behave better, not worse. And the same probably applies, we'll see it next month, to North Korea. They always saw in front of them a totally unpredictable administration, and they decided to warm up relations with the South rather than to risk a clash with the United States, especially once they already have the nuclear technology and they know how to keep developing their arsenal. So that's the good news. The bad news is that, you know, if the Iranians somewhere down the stream, let's say 3 years from now, decide to break out from the agreement and resume enrichment of uranium, they will surely argue that they do not break the agreement. The first one to break it were the Americans. And once again, the same applies to the North Koreans. If this meeting will happen in 12th of June in Singapore, in the summit, for sure, the North Korean the negotiators will raise the question, what sense it makes to negotiate a deal with an American president if the next president can wake up some morning and just cancel it?
I guess I want to take you back to the notion of regime change that you suggested that the Iranians might fear. Were there a change in regime? Were there military action leading to the fall of the current regime in Iran? What would follow it? What would succeed?
The Iranian remain a potential threat in the long term. At the present, they are not existential threat. They cannot turn into existential threat overnight, over 2 or 3 years. It will take a much longer period, and we should be on guard not to let them come closer to nuclear capability. In the meantime, they are trying to deploy in Syria, and we have to struggle with much more technical or immediate threats. They deploy proxies close to our borders. They try to develop or to deploy drones, sometimes armed drones and other means to limit or constrain our freedom of action over the Syrian airspace. And most importantly, they try to upgrade the accuracy, the precision of missiles in the hands of Hezbollah. There are tens of thousands of those missiles which cover basically most of Israel. So we, Israel, are determined to act to stop this deployment, these efforts on Syrian ground. And that's created a lot of tension in the recent weeks. We are doing it for a long time, but recently somehow it came to the public eye and raises more tension and more carries with it more risk. We are determined to continue it. But at the same time, we have to make sure we do not deteriorate into a full-scale war, which doesn't serve anyone, for sure not Israel.
So let's talk about the region more broadly. In Syria, you have this ongoing war. In Yemen, there is an ongoing war. Many of the leaders in the Arab League are pretty distracted, focused internally. Is this an environment that is conducive to making large, bold decisions? Back to our original conversation about the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. Are your neighbors in a position to be helpful and a road toward peace?
Unfortunately, the Arab Spring, as we called it 5 or 6 years ago, turned into Islamist winter. And some failing states like Iraq and Syria and probably in the future probably Lebanon. But there is still an axis of moderate Sunnite leaders that somehow stand firm. The Gulf states, Saudi Arabia, Egypt, Jordan. And there is clear common interest to all those moderate Sunni states and Israel. And the common interest is to corner or put at bay the Iranian hegemonic and nuclear intentions, to struggle together against radical Muslim terror, and to join hands in huge infrastructure projects which are needed, energy, water, you name it. But this great opportunity, I call it a once in a generation opportunity to get Israel accepted into the region, relationship normalized, engaging with the Arab neighbors freely in public. This won't fly unless Israel will be ready to take severe steps towards the Palestinians. Severe, I mean sincere steps toward the Palestinians. Reason is not that those Sunni leaders have a love affair with the Palestinian people or leadership. They don't. But the peoples have. And these moderate leaders do not feel safe in their own seats if they engage with Israel, normalize relationship, publicly cooperating with Israel, while Israel is still suppressing, as they call it, the Palestinian population on both the Judea, Samaria, and Gaza Strip. So I thought that it deserved our consideration because the challenge is great. We, in regard to Palestinians, we usually say, oh, you know, we can only give them, they cannot give us anything, which is not exactly accurate, but that's the conventional wisdom. With the all Arab Sunni community, we have a lot to get. It's a great change in our predisposition or posturing in the Middle East. If we are accepted by the Saudis, by the Gulf states and others as a normal member of the Middle Eastern community. So I see no reason to miss this opportunity. We always complain about the Palestinians that they do not miss an opportunity to miss an opportunity. We should not adopt this behavior. And we should do something. And as I mentioned, because most of our security leadership, including the present leadership of the IDF, of Tzal, the present leadership of the Secret Service, the Shabak, the present leadership of Mossad, they all recommend to the government take steps to let the steam out of this pressure cooker called Gaza, and the same applies in different way to Judea and Samaria. Make the concrete steps, and they put the proposals on the table of the government. And I should tell you honestly that even some of the government ministers, there is a prominent government minister named Katz, who proposed an artificial island in front of the Gaza shore. He said, why don't we let the Arabs build for them an artificial island which will have a seaport, probably an airport, well controlled for security by international force and probably Israeli cameras and microphone, doesn't matter. These are all technicalities, but why don't we let them an exit to the world and access to normal life? And once again, when we deal with the immediate problems along the fence and the border in Gaza, and we have sometimes to shoot, and because we do not have means to control riots of thousands from distances of 300 yards. We have sophisticated riot control means for dealing with several hundred people from 30 yards, but not many thousands from 300 yards. And we cannot afford the border to be crossed. So somehow we have to not just to deal with the mosquitoes, but once again, to drain the swamp, to look at the root causes and tackle them. And I cannot tell you why our government doesn't listen to this need, both as a precondition for regional order that will be a great achievement and as a immediate security means to reduce just the security tensions.
I'm going to end with a question about advice that you might offer to our president, to President Trump, when it comes to the region, and in particular the Palestinian-Israeli conflict, and also sort of harken back to a conversation you had with President Obama in your effort to help him understand the Israeli point of view, a conversation about schoolyard bullies. Say something about your advice to President Obama and what your advice would be to President Trump.
No, there is an element which I repeated with Obama and earlier with President Bush Jr. When it comes to decisions which are critical to the future and security of Israel in a way of the Jewish people, we will act as sovereign. We cannot afford to delegate our responsibility to anyone on earth, including our best friends, who happen to be you. We will take our decisions and act upon them, and we expect you to respect it. And in fact, the issue was at the time, it was the possibility of an Israeli independent attack on Iranian nuclear facilities. But they none of them was happy from this answer, but none of them questions the right of Israel as a sovereign. And in a way, when there was some ideas in Israel to intervene in regard to the political deals that America signed with Iran together with other powers, I made the following observation. I told Bibi and Lieberman, we can as Israeli politicians who happen to know many senators and many congressmen on first name basis, we of course shouldn't hide our reservations from the agreement. We can call them, we can talk to them, we can try to convince them, but we cannot act as the Israeli government against American internal political processes. We cannot come to the Congress and try to convince the Congress to vote against the decisions of American freely elected president. He seems to be satisfied. You know, for him, the triumph, electoral triumph of Trump and many of his steps is validating his positions, Bibi's position. But I think that it's all temporary. We still have to wait and see what are the longer term consequences. As of now, I should tell you that many in the Middle East like very much the positions of Trump. He basically came and told them, oh, let's stop with nation building, stop with human rights, democracy, let's focus on struggling against terror and cornering Iran. And that's something that Middle Eastern leaders understand and want to see happen.
You're listening to World Affairs, the weekly broadcast of the World Affairs Council. I'm Jane Wales. To hear this broadcast or any other World Affairs program that you may have missed on KQED, you can download our podcasts on our iTunes channel or wherever you get your podcasts. Search for World Affairs. That's one word. We've just heard from Ehud Barak, the former prime minister and former minister of defense of Israel. And we're turning now to Marwan Muasher. He's the former minister of foreign affairs and the former deputy prime minister of Jordan. When you were foreign minister, you played a central role in developing both the Arab Peace Initiative and the Middle East Roadmap, and each called for a two-state solution. It was embraced by the Arab League, by the Quartet, and with some reservations by successive Israeli governments. What has changed since then? How has the political calculation changed for each of the parties? I guess let's start with the United States, which was Israel's strongest ally.
A lot of things have changed. On the diplomatic or the political level, of course, the United States is no longer wedded to the two-state solution. In fact, it is taking positions that are very pro-biased towards Israel. You have an Israeli government which is no longer interested in a two-state solution. Mr. Netanyahu has at least not a two-state solution that would meet the minimum aspirations of the Palestinians, and you have Mr. Netanyahu clearly stating that. And most importantly, on the ground, things have changed dramatically. When the peace process started, when the Oslo agreements were signed in 1993, you had 250,000 settlers in the West Bank and East Jerusalem. Today, there are 650,000. So the issue of separating the two communities and affecting a two-state solution has become demographically, geographically impossible, even if the political will existed to affect such a solution.
And with the demographics changing, obviously the birth rate is a lot higher amongst Palestinian Arabs versus Israeli Jews. What does that bode for a one-state solution?
Well, if you look at the number of Israeli Jews and Palestinian Arabs in the areas under Israel's control today, that is Israel proper, the West Bank, and Gaza, you have today, according to official Israeli statistics, 6.5 million Israeli Jews versus 6.5 million Palestinian Arabs. That means with the birth rate, the higher birth rate of Palestinians versus Israelis that you referred to, That means that in a generation's time, the number of Palestinians is going to be, you know, greater, much greater than that of the Israelis. If there is no two-state solution, then the Palestinian Arabs, if they are not able to, you know, exist in their own state, are going to demand the next logical thing, which is equal rights within the state they live in. That is a one-state solution that obviously the Israelis are not ready to accept, because it will mean the destruction of Israel as a Jewish state and certainly as a democratic state within the Israeli community. But that is the only logical solution that I can see if a two-state solution is not possible.
Yeah, we'll turn to that in a moment. I first want to get a sense of the Arab neighbors. The Arab League is nowhere near as strong now as it was back then. Many of the Arab states seem to be pretty internally focused. I mean, you've got Syria is in a war, Yemen's in a war, Egypt has had to take a pretty authoritarian approach, and they're shifting alliances. How would you describe the neighborhood? Is there a focus on the Palestinian plight amongst members of the Arab League?
Remember when the Arab Peace Initiative was passed, this was 2002, when the conditions existed then to shift the emphasis and talk about a regional solution instead of just a Palestinian-Israeli solution. Those conditions no longer exist. The Arab Peace Initiative was not an indefinite peace initiative on the table, even though all Arab states still cling to it, and no Arab state has withdrawn its signature from it. But the facts on the ground are different. As you said, Arab states are more internally focused now on their domestic challenges. And the whole premise of the Arab Peace Initiative has gone.
And what about their own populations? Are they particularly focused on the Palestinian plight?
I don't think the Palestinian issue has, been forgotten among Arab populations. Certainly the focus today is on domestic challenges. It does not mean that the issue has forgotten. It just means an immediate focusing on their domestic solutions. But whether they are or not does not negate from the fact that we are facing a situation today in the occupied territories where a two-state solution is becoming impossible to implement, and where people have to, whether they like it or not, start thinking of other alternatives. The one-state solution, of course, being among the most obvious of these alternatives.
Now, you've called for reimagining Palestine. What would that look like?
As I said, both communities today still prefer a two-state solution for obvious reasons, because they don't want just their individual rights. They want their collective rights as well. And these collective rights can only be exercised when the two communities have their own state. But wishing something to happen does not mean it will happen. And today, facts on the ground are such that even for someone like me, who has spent most of his career trying to implement a two-state solution and trying to contribute to that effort, today, if I am to be realistic, I no longer believe that such a solution is possible. What does a one-state solution look like? There are many variations of this solution. One where you talk about the liberal version, where every person enjoys equal rights, that satisfies individual rights for both communities but does not satisfy collective rights. You talk about maybe a binational state in which you respect both the individual rights but also the collective rights, maybe in a federal structure like that of Switzerland or some other country like that. There are many variations, but just talk about a two-state solution because it is the preferred outcome of everybody, including that of the international community, does not mean such a solution is today possible, I'm afraid.
Help us think about, sort of get into the minds of the Palestinians who live in various occupied territories, or including living also as refugees in Jordan and Lebanon and elsewhere. How do the young people think about their national identity?
I think we are witnessing a marked shift in the views of the young generation of Palestinians in the occupied territories, and all polls suggest that they are no longer focused on the shape of the solution, and they have sort of shifted their struggle from focusing on the shape of a solution to focusing on their rights. What they are saying is, yes, we do want a two-state solution, but if a two-state solution is not possible, then we need to focus on acquiring our civil and political rights, on raising the cost of the occupation in peaceful terms, in supporting campaigns like the boycott campaign against Israeli products, etc. And wherever that leads us, let it be. But we cannot keep, hoping for a two-state solution that is not coming. The two-state solution that is talked about by, this perceived U.S. plan or perceived Israeli plan talks about a solution without East Jerusalem, without the Jordan Valley, with every settlement in the West Bank, without the right of return. I mean, all of these things are not attractive to the young generation. And they are saying, if this is the type of the solution we're being offered, thank you very much. We'd rather reshift the struggle to, like I said, focusing on our rights.
Now, for self-governance to work, for a democracy to work for the Palestinians as well as Israeli Jews, you really need robust civil society. And that's something that's been lacking in the region by and large. Are you seeing civil society emerging now?
Well, I don't think it's lacking everywhere. Civil society is very strong among the Palestinians. It is one that has, for example, allowed them to persevere during the first Intifada. Civil society is very flourishing in Tunisia, but it's also flourishing in countries that are witnessing civil strife. Civil society is very strong in Syria, for example. And even in Egypt, where civil society is being really, fought by the Egyptian authorities, civil society, even if it is working sometimes below, the ground, is still very strong. So I'm very hopeful about civil society in the Arab world. Governments have not been able to answer the call of their population for better governance. And people are taking things into their own hand increasingly, even under difficult conditions. So I think the future of civil society in the Arab world is very promising.
Now, I know that you've been working on building civil society in Jordan and perhaps elsewhere. In your writing, you say a big problem is that what's lacking in the Arab world is a commitment to pluralism, a situation in which different cultures can live happily side by side within a larger shared society. Is that still the case? Or are you seeing that change?
No, that is certainly the case. I see the main struggle in the Arab world is a struggle for pluralism, is a struggle for accepting different points of view and different ideas, and for all these ideas to coexist peacefully. I think the main problem in the Arab world, and this is substantiated by all the polls that have been taken, the main problem is a lack of good governance, is authoritarianism, is one party, one person, one force deciding on their own what society should be like, and everybody else is supposed to, go in line. That is not that does not form the basis for any living society in which different ideas are allowed to flourish, are allowed to exist, and are allowed to experiment. A lot of people here in the region see this struggle as a struggle between the secularists and the Islamists. I don't see it as such, because both, forces are here to stay, and I don't think it is possible for any force to negate the other. I think the struggle should be one where both the secularists and the Islamists can coexist under a constitution that is man-made and that sets the rules of the game, precisely as the Tunisians, for example, have done successfully.
Now, when you were deputy prime minister, you focused on political and economic development in Jordan. What about for the region? Is there a commitment? And of course, you also were at the World Bank, so this is an area of expertise for you. Are you seeing any kind of coalescing around infrastructure projects, anything that will promote economic development as well as political reform?
I think one of the challenges and problems in the Arab world is that it has for a long time focused on economic reform only, without political reform. What that has done, and when I say without political reform, I mean that as you privatize, as you integrate into the world's economy, you need to also make sure that there is a body that is supervising this process, making sure it is checking abuses when they happen, etc. So without the development of a strong legislative body and a strong judicial body, the executive in the Arab world has dominated the scene, and therefore most economic activities and most economic reform processes in the Arab world ended up benefiting the cronies around the regime rather than the general population. And today most of the population in the Arab world associate economic reform not with improvement of their lot, but rather with corruption. What we need in the region is a process that goes together where political and economic reform form, you know, two columns, two bases for a rejuvenation process. We are facing in the Arab world a new now perfect storm, if you will, which is the decline of oil prices that has been happening since 2014. Oil has been used both by oil producing countries and oil importing countries to sustain an inefficient economic system that is based on rent money, that is based on money coming out of the ground rather than on productivity for economic activity. Now that there is a decline in oil prices, economic reform cannot take place without political reform, simply because there is not enough money to sustain economic system which is not based on merit.
You know, where one of the places this is most striking is in Saudi Arabia, where so many people are employed by the government, in essence, because of its oil wealth, this has been possible. Is Saudi Arabia thinking through the kind of post-oil world that they are facing? I think of the Crown Prince and some of the initiatives he's championed.
The Saudis are trying to, put in place an economic reform process that has become necessary since the decline in oil prices that I talked about. As they do that, they are asking their citizens to accept, you know, the removal of subsidies, to accept taxes on their income, to accept higher energy prices. A lot of things that the Saudis are not used to are being asked of them now. Can you keep doing that without also giving the Saudis a voice in the running of their own country is, to me, highly questionable. I think that's part of what happened with the Arab Spring in Egypt, in Tunisia, when the old social contracts collapsed, social contracts that promised people economic benefits in return for no voice in decision-making. And when the economic benefits started subsiding because governments became inflated and could no longer provide adequate health and education services, could no longer provide jobs, could no longer provide subsidies, but government still insisted on people having no voice in running their own affairs. That's when the Arab Spring took place. In places like Saudi Arabia, they have been able to sustain the situation because of oil prices. Now that oil prices are down, in my view, I think the Saudis are going to face this big challenge of, can they do economic reform without political reform? In my own view, they cannot.
And they're very involved right now in a war in Yemen. Is that a distraction for them? Is that part of rallying support? How is that playing domestically?
Of course. I mean, the war in Yemen serves no purpose in my view. It is costing the Saudis money they no longer have. It is a humanitarian disaster. In the end, you know, this is a war. This is an issue between different factions of Yemeni society. They're all Yemenis. They have to sit together and come up with their own social contract. And, you know, whether it is the Saudis or the Iranians or anybody else, it's not their business to decide on this social contract. This should be a largely Yemeni affair. And I think the Saudis are coming to terms, maybe slowly, but they are coming to terms with this and seeing the Yemeni sort of adventure as largely useless.
How about the U.S.? It's involved in the war in Yemen. It appears to have been increasing its involvement under the Trump administration. How wise is that?
The Trump administration is taking a very, black and white view of the region. And in my view, it is a view that is not informed by the experts. The United States has, under the Trump administration, has not been making use of the State Department, for example, or the experts that know the region well. And so the decisions that I see being taken by the United States really lack knowledge of the nuances that exist in this region. I'm very worried about such a simplistic and black and white view.
So we're talking about, I mean, obviously it's more than a fragile moment in both Yemen and Syria. They're both deep in war. Is this a fragile moment for Saudi Arabia and others?
It is a difficult moment for Saudi Arabia. Remember that unemployment among Saudis is over 30%. So contrary to the view that Saudi is a very rich country, they do have significant economic challenges. They do have also political challenges as well. They have an educational system which has been very closed over the years. The government now is trying to open up this educational system, but whether they will be able to do that and also face the economic and political challenges they face, you know, these are huge challenges. No one can predict what will happen, but I think that the Saudis can no longer rely on oil revenue to basically solve most of the problems that they had.
Now, you've started something called the Civil Alliance. Is that focused on building civil society in Jordan, or does it go beyond?
The Civil Alliance is a party in making, a political party in making. Not just started by me. I mean, we are a group of people who are focused on youth, who believe in programmatic parties that should give socioeconomic answers to the problems that countries face and not just stop at ideological slogans. And so we're a new experiment in Jordan, and such experiments that are, largely started by civil society are new. You are seeing increasingly a dissatisfaction among people with both sort of governments who have not delivered and with ideological parties who were high on slogans and short on delivery. We are trying to offer a third way in which we present detailed socioeconomic programs to deal with countries' problems and where we focus on youth also as the engine of change in the future.
Now, one of the characteristics of Jordan is that it has been generous, as have the Lebanese, to Palestinian refugees. It has been the home of many of them. What kind of political and economic pressure does that create for Jordan?
Jordan is different than Lebanon in that it has given most of the refugees that came to Jordan after the 1948 war Jordanian citizenship. So while, yes, we do have some Palestinians, like people from Gaza, who are not Jordanian citizens, the vast majority of Palestinians who came to the country in 48 are today Jordanian citizens and have been so since 2 or 3 generations. Lebanon is different in that the Palestinians have not been given Lebanese citizenship. So in Jordan, what, for example, our party calls for is to treat everybody equally, everybody that has already Jordanian citizens, and not to look at their origin as the only sure way to build a country in which all citizens feel they are equal.
So I'm going to take you back before we close, take you back to the Israeli-Palestinian conflict for a moment, because recently Islamic militants in Gaza attacked southern Israel with rockets, and Israel responded with airstrikes. Where do you see that headed?
Well, I mean, you know, to put things in simple terms, the real issue is the occupation. Gaza is a big prison. People in Gaza who are today over, 1.8 million people cannot go freely in and out of Gaza. So the tensions are going to continue so long as the occupation is there. If the occupation ends, that is the only sure way to start, a peaceful era in the Arab world. I don't see that happening. And so, we have seen three wars on Gaza in the last 10 years. And that, unfortunately, is going to continue to happen so long as the occupation is still there.
As you think about, you've talked about moving to a rights-based approach and that civil society is growing to the point that maybe self-governance is possible. This is all in the context of deprivation when it comes to Gaza. I mean, two-fifths of Gazans are unemployed. They only have electricity 3 hours a day, can't treat their sewage. Does deprivation lead to despair, or is leadership emerging?
Gaza is in an impossible situation. You know, it has been, as I said, isolated by the Israelis. It is a big prison. Conditions are people are, you have overcrowding in Gaza to a big extent. So Gaza has serious economic challenges even without the occupation. You bring the occupation in and it becomes impossible. And, there are ideas today that says, let's leave Gaza alone and let's have a state in the West Bank without Gaza. That's a recipe for disaster. You cannot keep people deprived in such a way and hope for a peaceful region around you in the future. So any solution to the Palestinian issue has to involve Gaza, in my view.
And as you know, we're all focused on Hamas and have been for quite a while. How do you see it evolving in a world in which you can have a rights-based approach and a single state solution?
Well, I mean, if in any solution, let's say a two-state solution is affected or a single state solution is affected, then Hamas, of course, has to become a political party that does not carry arms. The carrying of arms has to be something that only the state should be able to do. Today, Hamas is, citing the occupation as a reason for them carrying arms. But under a scenario where we have a solution to the Arab-Israeli conflict, then the only party that can carry arms is the state.
You've been listening to World Affairs, the weekly broadcast of the World Affairs Council. Ours is a nonprofit membership organization. We're dedicated to engaging the public in conversations that matter. You can visit us on worldaffairs.org. This program featured a conversation with Ehud Barak. He's the former Prime Minister and former Minister of Defense of Israel. And Marwan Moasher, former Minister of Foreign Affairs and former Deputy Prime Minister of Jordan. This broadcast is made possible each week by the generous support of Chevron and the Draper Richards Kaplan Foundation. Our technical supervisor is Monte Carlos. World Affairs is produced in association with KQED Public Radio. I'm Jane Wales. Thank you for joining us.